The Sporland Division of Parker Hannifin Corporation is sponsoring this podcast. Sporland is the leading manufacturer of HVAC and R components. Using quality materials and craftsmanship, Sporland maintains a commitment to innovation, manufacturing excellence, service, and support for its customers since 1934. The company is known for its catch-all filter dryers, thermostatic expansion valves, solenoid valves, pressure regulating valves, suction filters, electric valves, controllers, supermarket monitoring solutions, chemicals, smart service tools, ZoomLock Max Press to Connect, and ZoomLock Push to Connect refrigerant fittings. If folks want to learn more, what do they do?
You can go to Sporland.com.
I guess that's Jim and John for Sporland signing off.
This episode is sponsored by United Refrigeration and Westermeyer Industries, revolutionizing your HVACR experience. Visit URI.com for all your HVACR needs, offering real-time inventory, personalized pricing, and a nearby stock feature. Access quick pick replacement parts and branch details effortlessly. With 350-plus fully stocked locations across North America, our knowledgeable staff are ready to assist with the solutions you need. Exclusive offer. Use code ARPOD on URI.com to get a $10 gift card when purchasing the Westermeyer Oil Float, part number W4300-38F. These high-performance floats are not just compatible with their own oil separators, but also available as a crossover model. Conveniently stocked at United Refrigeration. That's code ARPOD to claim your $10 gift card. Visit URI.com now.
Awesome. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Advanced Refrigeration Podcast. You hear the host Brett Wetzel and Kevin Compass. And it's been a while since we actually did one of these together, it feels like.
Yeah, between vacations and people getting sick, and it's been a rough one.
Where are you out this week?
I am in the cheapest hotel that I could find in Boulder, Colorado. That was still absolutely outrageous.
Yeah.
I am helping with some EMS conversions, so slow back home. So we're just finishing up some jobs out here so these guys get some help, and then I'm headed back home.
Cool. I'm out in sunny California again. Hopefully this is going to be the last time for a while. I'm learning how to train on the Danfoss trainer that we purchased a couple months back, and I'm out working with Preben from Danfoss. He's from Denmark and incredibly brilliant dude. And Brian Rogers is out here too. And we're going through basically all the ins and outs and trying to figure out how this thing works. And a lot of times we'll get to a point where we'll find something, and then all of a sudden he's like, oh shit, it's been a while. All right, hold on, let me think about that. It's just because a lot of the features that they put on there, this is when they first started really using CO2. So like they were talking about stuff and seeing how it was going to react, and then added stuff just in case stuff didn't work. So it's been fun. I'm actually having a really good time this week, other than losing my luggage and getting sick. And other than that, it's been a really good week. So. But yeah, this week we're actually talking with Don Gillis from Chemours, and I'm about to bring him on here. To the stage is Mr. Don Gillis, Mr. Announcer Voice. How you doing, sir?
Good, Brad. How are you? Hi, Kevin. Yeah, doing well.
How have you been? I talked to you for a little bit, like a couple months ago, and then it feels like I was like, yeah, I'll get back to you, and then nothing. And it was funny. When we went around the tactical awards, I'm like, that announcer sounds really freaking familiar. I was like, who the hell is that?
Yeah, I didn't get there on time. And when I walked in, everybody was going, I thought you were already in the room. I was trying to figure out, Eric Kaiser said, I assumed you were behind a curtain somewhere. I said, no. And we did that way back when. But yeah, I'm doing great. Working from home, unlike you guys, I'm actually working from home. And as we talked a little bit earlier today, this is the first week I've worked from home. And if my calculations are right, it's about 6 months now. So like you guys, I'm traveling very heavily, extensively right now.
Wait, 6 months?
Yeah, besides Christmas. But I literally landed the weekend before Christmas. I think Christmas was on a Monday. I was on a plane on December 26th when I regret it. Looking back on it, I told my wife, I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. It's just, the demand was there. And I'm one of those people, like we all are as contractors, you have a hard time saying no. You have good work ethics and you just go and you want to please everyone, but
do it. I'll do it.
If you're in a pinch, I'll help you out. And then everybody's got a pinch, right? So
the pinches stop and then they start hurting.
Yeah. Yeah.
The supermarket mindset.
Yeah, you know the ropes. You wouldn't be doing this if you can't stand being in a truck for 10, 12 hours or whatever nonstop. So I know you guys have been there. I've been there for sure. And you braise that way.
It's hard getting the good work ethic anymore. So it's good. And it's contagious though, I think. I think a lot of times, like if you show good work ethic and other people see that work ethic, that they want to work as hard as you. I think it's a really good thing.
I agree. Yeah. And I was growing up where I'm at right now. I still was born and raised at, and it's in a little farm community about 45 minutes from the city. I'm licensed in the city. I'm on the state line of Indiana and Ohio. I'm a Buckeye, but I'm licensed in Fort Wayne, where our oldest son is licensed also, but the work ethics is really good. So like I'm right in the middle of a cornfield basically. So it's a small village of nothing but farmers and manufacturers. And you grew up with, my parents were both blue collar union steel workers.
I didn't realize you were from Indiana.
Yeah, I'm from Ohio. Yeah. So I'm actually 45 minutes east. I'm to the Copeland plant in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And I'm about 15 minutes shorter to the airport in Fort Wayne than I am Dayton, Ohio. So I fly out of Fort Wayne because my drive is like through country fields as opposed to getting on the interstate I-75 to Dayton. And I drove a service truck to Fort Wayne for nearly 25 years. So
I've come to the conclusion that a lot of people...
You're not too far from me.
Yeah, I know. You're up there. I know about where you're at because I have a friend up by your way. Are you in Illinois, Kevin?
No, I live in Valparaiso.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I know a guy that works up at Johnstone's up there. I thought, and I've seen you, I've seen something that you were up in that way somewhere thereabouts. But yeah, you're real close to where I used to run. I used to run we were in geothermal, so I would run really far up around city of Fort Wayne. Like when Geo first came out, I would drive 2 hours sometimes to get to a geothermal unit. You know how it is, but yeah.
Damn. So Don, you're at Chemours now and tell anyone who doesn't know who you are, like where you actually, obviously you lived in Dayton, you've worked in Indiana, but where'd you end up after that?
Real quick condensed version. I was a laid off union steel worker 33 years ago, I think on April Fool's Day. Answered an ad, jumped in a truck, not too far from here, a Lennox dealership, mom and pops, and started working my way through things and eventually gravitated over to Fort Wayne. Like I said, I'm about 12 minutes inside the state line. Long story short, they grandfathered me in through the apprenticeship, did 4 years, get my journeyman's license for the county, and then basically moved up to a service manager position. Nothing major. We were very large. We bought a lot of equipment. More comfort cooling than refrigeration, but we did do some. And so anyways, just went throughout a lot of projects and stuff like that, and then got burnt out, to be honest with you. I was, again, going back to that work ethics thing. I'm one of those folks that, hey, 20 guys running call and on call and two at a time on call for the week or the weekend or whatever. You boys knew, hopefully they're not listening, who wasn't going to answer their calls. So it wasn't unusual to be on July 4th or something like that. And my wife jumping in the truck and say, hey, let's make a day out of it. So she's a good stick. And so anyways, I started getting burnt out of it and I was almost 400 pounds, blood pressure through the roof. I'm sure you guys get all this smoking, coffee, addict, monster drinks, all that stuff. And so I wanted to reinvent myself. I really honestly thought I was going to end up at a counter, even though I couldn't afford to work at a counter. I really decided, hey, I'm going to die here. Anyways, a friend of mine reached out that owned a bunch of branches. Kevin might know who they are. They used to be called Atlas Supply. A company called Ari Michael came in and bought the 12 branches he owned. And he stayed on as a regional and he hired me as a TM. And I've never really considered myself a salesman, but I did it for just under 2 years. And then a friend of mine working at Emerson Copeland, east of here, approximately about 45 minutes. We've got people here locally that work in the factory and what have you, reached out and said, hey, there's this position open. And I know you like to teach. And I know you always work hands-on with people throughout your career and stuff like that, whether it's technicians, maintenance guys or whatever. And you like to learn. And he knew I like to apply myself. So anyways, he said, apply for this. and they had to go through internally, and evidently they didn't find anybody. Long story short, they got it down to me and they made me an offer. And so that was about 6, 7, maybe going on close to 8 years ago now. Been with Chemours just under 2 years, was with Copeland and got involved in all their stuff right away. They shipped me into your guys' world that I wasn't familiar with. Again, I drew the short straw. They said, hey, you're going to be the guy that's going to teach CO2, or part of that guy. Okay. So Trevor Matthews and I went together in this. He was already there in Brantford, Ontario, and they moved me up there. When I say moved, flew me up there for training under Andre Patinod. And we just dove in. So it was like eat and breathe. And I would just read everything I could and all that stuff. So I became that, and the cost trainer, tearing down compressors. Again, I traveled literally, I think every year it was somewhere between 35, 36 to 38 weeks a year with Emerson. And I did that for the whole length of there. And then the summertime we'd build curriculum up. So every time something new came out, they would say, hey, Don, would you mind? I think they thought that I caught on fairly quick. So whether it was the new VFDs or whatever, there was always some new products. I was getting overwhelmed with all the product. Loved Emerson, but just a great place to work for. But Chemours approached me, to put it bluntly, and made me an offer a couple of years ago, actually at the ESCO event. And they said, hey, we like what Copeland's doing in that educational area, and we'd like to duplicate it. And would you like to be a part of that? It really went more, hey, if you know anybody, wink, wink, let us know, kind of thing. So we talked, and you know how things go when offers come along. And so I'm here now trying to duplicate or build up my thoughts and your thoughts and everyone else's thoughts that invented all this stuff before I came along, and just putting it in my words and preaching it, if you will. And it's going quite well. Our dance card is full. And so, yeah, that's a very long version. I'm sorry you had to go through that, Brett, but that's the version.
You did say a bridge, and I was like, wait a minute, he's keep going. That's too cool, man.
And I didn't even have any coffee.
I think I'm 2 Red Bulls and a coffee already. This week just sucked. It's been an awful week. It's just been a horrible week. Getting over a cold, I was like deathly ill on Monday. I was waiting for the sweet touch of death. I'm feeling better now, so that's good. So, Don, you're on here to talk about A2Ls. So,
yeah.
Where do you want to start?
Well, where do you want to start? Let's talk about what's happening, I guess. We'll start. I didn't really have anything prepared as far as in order or anything like that, but yeah. Everyone knows by now we're moving to these lower GWP refrigerants. We'll start with residential stuff because that's the first thing that's getting enacted. As of January 1st of 2025, they won't be able to manufacture that 410A equipment anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It'll have to be something lower than 700 GWP. Obviously, Chemours has a product, R454B. They actually have a 454 series, A, B, and C. A is for medium low temp. C is for medium low temp. The difference there is the GWP. One's 148, one's 240 something. The way it's written up in the technical transition is that you have to have, as the cutoff is 200 pounds. So if you're below 200 pounds, you have to be below 150 GWP. If you're above 200 pounds, you have to be above or below 300, I think it is. Yeah, I know it is. So okay. I see you nodding your head, so you understand all this already.
No, I thought for some reason, I thought it was 50 pounds. I thought it was 50 pounds. Is that a California rule?
Might be a California rule. After the AMAC came about, quite honestly, I was all over CARB for a long time until the AMAC came out. So the CARB might have something differently in there. The federal level, the EPA, okay. At the federal level is what I'm referring to. And
that's fine. Yeah. I'm in with a lot of stuff in California, and they're like, I keep hearing, oh yeah, we can't do anything that's over 150 GWP at 50 pounds. And I could be totally wrong. Maybe I'm talking about my butt. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you might be right. That seems a little, I don't know. So I'm not going to comment on that. I don't know for sure. It seems a little aggressive, but I could be wrong. I do know that they're a little more lenient on the air conditioning side of things, like our GWP for the AIM Act for the states at the federal level is 700. And we thought it was going to be 750 like California. As California goes, usually the U.S. goes, right? And they were at 750. And it was a surprise a lot of us when the AIM Act came out and said it had to be 700 or lower. Because when you look at R32, which was a front runner for the longest time and mm-hmm. still is really, it's been around for a long time and it's in a lot of things we use, right? So that's like 6-7, somewhere there, 677, somewhere thereabouts. So that's pretty close to that 700 mark. But yeah, so it's a 200-pound cutoff. And that's the way I teach it to other trainers also. There's that, just remember there's a 200-pound cutoff. Anything below 200 pounds, 150 GWP or less, anything above 200 pounds. And that's in your transition rule, which is the second step of that AIM Act. I know the politics of it isn't the most exciting thing to talk about, but the first step is the allocations, right? How much you can manufacture. So the goal of that real quick is, I don't usually spend a lot of time on the AIM Act, is to be down to 15% by 2036 and those kind of things. I'm sure you've had lots of people on talk about this before, but I'm not a gambling person or a betting person, but I'm pretty sure that I'm 100% sure, or nearly 100% sure, that recovery and reclaiming refrigerant will never be more important than I've ever seen in my lifetime anyways. It's going to be like gold. In fact, you're already seeing it in the industry where folks that never used to take reclaimed refrigerant are now starting that business up, or startup businesses that are only going to take refrigerant. There, you see them growing really fast. They're out shouting at the top of mountains right now, bring us your refrigerant. And what I've learned is, years ago when I was in a truck and you were in a truck, or maybe you're still in a truck, that, you know, you would used to not get anything for it, or even sometimes be penalized. Now they have the digital technology, if you will, to go through that, those refrigerants, and whether it's four refrigerants in there and burnt oil and dyes and all that stuff, they can, from what I understand, I've heard this said many a times, they can separate those. Now, is it as worth as much as something, a tank of one refrigerant, like 404A or something like that? No, obviously not, but it's worth value, way more. And you're going to see a big, lot of traction in that area moving forward. The third part of the AIM Act, and I want to get out of here on the EPA part of it for you, but that's in limbo right now. I refer to it as muddy. I don't talk about it because I don't want to muddy the water. But it said things like, it was the reclamation part of the third step of the AIM Act, and it had to do with refillable tanks like Canada does. It had to do with QR tracking on the tanks. It had to do with, by a certain year, a certain amount of percentage, let's say 10% of the refrigerant used in new equipment had to be reclaimed refrigerant. So it was all about reclamation and putting that stuff in. Because when virgin refrigerant's used for the first time, the GWP, that gets penalized, right? That has a GWP value. But the beauty of reclaimed refrigerant in the EPA's eyes, and everyone's eyes really, is it's already been penalized. So it doesn't get penalized a second time. So the more you recover and we can use reclaimed refrigerant, that's like a break-even type thing. There is a little bit of emissions there for processing it, but it doesn't get penalized. So that's the beauty of it. We don't buy virgin refrigerant R22 anymore in the States. If you're buying it, you're buying it illegal. But so it's the same concept, really.
So I have a question for you. Oh my God, I think I just lost it. That was quick. That was short-lived. No, it had something to do with the reclaim cylinders. What have you heard that's going on with there? Because I heard that they were having a hard time just even coming up, and I know you said not to talk about CO2, but we have a problem with just getting cylinders created. So what are you hearing with that?
So they're going to be, and you can talk about CO2. I have no problem with that.
I want to keep the stay to, I just brought it up because I'm having a hard time getting cylinders created.
That. So recovery tanks, from my understanding, and this is hot off the press, is that if it wasn't last week, it was the week before that supposedly they went into production. So as of 2 weeks ago, there was none made, not even one. There was a prototype at AHRI, because I get these questions all the time. People reach out, people that do podcasts and different things, they want a sample to show it on their videos like we're doing now. And the answer has been no. I've looked everywhere. We've all looked everywhere, and they're just not out there. From very reliable sources, I was told, I believe it was last week or 2 weeks ago, that they would have went into production. So it's happening right now. As far as what you're going to see on those recovery tanks, let's start with the smaller ones. You're going to see the red stripe like you are on the A2L refrigerants. And they finally finalized and agreed that they are going to go with left-handed threads also on the recovery tanks. So those will be two indicators similar to what we're going to be buying the refrigerant like. So that has been confirmed. The left-hand threads, I thought a year ago, were already decided on, but evidently a month or so ago, I heard that was still in debate. Now it's finalized. There will be left-handed threads on the recovery tanks and also the red band. So be looking for that.
There was something weird with the relief too, I thought.
The relief valve, the relief on the new tanks will be, what we're accustomed to using is the rupture disc. Mm-hmm. And you know how the ruptured disc works. I live in Ohio and worked in Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and or surrounding area, but we don't get very hot here. So I've never personally seen a ruptured disc go off. A lot of people throw the number 130 degrees around. It's really based on pressure because there's going to be a different pressure temperature, as you obviously know. 130 comes from storage. That's where that number comes from. Don't want to store above 130 degrees. But with that said, the way the ruptured disc works is when it gets above that temperature, whatever that pressure is, that set point, that ruptured disc ruptures and it blows the whole charge instead of something catastrophic and turned into a giant hand grenade, if you will. The new design, and it wasn't required. It was just something the tank manufacturers decided they wanted to take the extra step. It's a relief valve, a spring loaded relief valve. And exactly. That's what I say, the same thing. And I say they burp. It was what they do. If you understand relief valves, they just burp. They relieve enough pressure, even though it's fairly close to the flammability we're using now. And I mean that sincerely. And I can show you some pictures too. It's just, they took the extra step. I thought it was required up until about 7 months ago. And here I found out it's not from our internal people that work on those type projects. It was just, they decided to go the extra mile and do that. But so just to be safe there. So there was a myth out there not long ago that the tanks were going to have to be upright. I was watching a webinar a couple months ago and it was unfortunate. There was a couple thousand people or near 2,000, and the person said A2L tanks will have to be stored upright. And I don't like to sling mud, but I just want to make it clear that's not the case. A2Ls will be able to lay on the side. I think what they were trying to say was you have to get a special permit. And I'm going to blow Chemours' horn here because it's a true story. So about 2.5 years ago, the Department of Transportation did not want those tanks laid on the side. And the theory was, or their thinking was, that if you lay it on the side and that relief valve, let's say, is at the 6 o'clock position in your rack, that the liquid could possibly, so they wanted to vapor barrier. You get it, Brett, you get it, Kevin. Yeah. So they wanted to vapor barrier. That was the whole purpose of the upright thing. Chemours did all the testing prior to me coming here. So they did all this footwork and they kept getting pushed back and getting denied. And then finally they did the complete testing, sent it in, and they allowed it. So all the manufacturers, our competitors, if you're listening, anyone out there, all they have to do now is literally file for that permit to get a permit number. And it's a permit number that's stamped on the tank, basically, is what it means. But all the homework's been done, basically, for the industry, if you will. If you hear that it's going to be up vertically, that's myth bust that one, too.
Wow. Kevin, I keep asking all the questions. I feel like I'm cutting you off. Is there anything you want to ask before I ask this next one?
No, I got really shitty internet, so it's fine. The one question I had, Don, is, so what are these tanks coming in like size-wise? Is it still like the standard 25 pounds and then 100-pound cylinders, or are we limited
to less? So the large cylinders are going to be the same. The tanks on the smaller ones are going to weigh 20 pounds, okay? And the reason for that is, because I get a lot of questions about that, is because of the density. So I'm comparing 410A to 454B, for example. And that has to do with the density of the refrigerant. It will weigh out at 20 pounds. So if you're using a multiplier, let's say 0.06, I believe, for 410A, it'll be like 0.055, I believe, is what it is. So it's 5.5 compared to 6. So it'll be slightly changed. So if you're using 6, you can still use that. And I'm talking about comfort cooling, obviously. But yeah, the tanks will drop 5 pounds, but it has to do with the density of the refrigerant.
How about transporting across bridges?
That's a great transportation, and the big box trucks or the semis, I don't really get into that world that much. I wish I knew more in that area, but I don't. Speak mostly on the service vehicles, but I don't really know the do's and don'ts of the transportation on the larger vehicles. On service vehicles, no placards, no, what was before is now. What I mean by that, you couldn't have more than 440 pounds of anything in multiple tanks in your truck before, whether that's settling or whatever it is. It still stayed at 440 pounds. Let me pull that one up for you if you want to see it. Let me see here real quick if I can find it real fast here.
Kevin, you've never had more than 440 pounds on a vehicle at one point, right?
Oh, I never blown the springs out of my service van.
Never blew the tranny out.
I've had 100 pound cylinder stacked to the top of the van.
That's why this is news to me. I've never heard that before.
Now I just hit, okay, I'm just sharing my screen, right, guys?
Gotta hit present.
Yes.
Slide whatever into the blank screen.
Okay.
Oh, I'm getting there. Yep.
Hey, look at you, man. Lake. All right.
Oh, man.
Thank you very much. I'm learning all the time.
Me too.
So, yeah. I actually had to take a PowerPoint class last year because after they hired me, I said, I think you made a mistake. I'm not really a curriculum builder. I'm better at turning wrenches than I am curriculum building, but I did learn it.
So my
slides are a little hokey. Some of this stuff, I just pulled the pictures off the internet, but if you can see that, so here's what the truck's going to look like, the service vehicles. Under the material trade, it's business as usual. The 440 pounds, regardless of the hazard. No placards required in the service vehicles. Also, and these were myth-busting things. Basically, these were myths that I heard throughout my travels and different things. No ventilation required. And again, A2L tanks will be able to lay horizontally on that. Just some facts on that there. Let me see where I'm at with this. Let me get in here real quick.
So, Don, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's probably stupid, but about tunnels. Is it a problem? Because technically you can't take anything flammable in a tunnel.
Like propane?
You're not even supposed to have acetylene.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that you weren't.
Yeah, like propane cylinders. We were going camping.
Yeah. Interesting. So you're saying when you're driving on a road in a tunnel that you can't have like your propane going through there?
Yeah, really? We were just coming through Kentucky into Tennessee and going through the mountain, and I'm looking, and I'm like, oh, no propane cylinders, like no flammable any cylinder at all, which makes sense, I guess, if you're in a tunnel.
Yeah. Here's, and I'm not knocking propane because I've used it my whole life. I've converted a lot of furnaces over. I taught hydrocarbons prior to coming here. I understand 290 really well. I do want to show you something since we're on that topic. Let's go to that topic a little bit. And I'm not a big smoking mirrors, snake oil kind of guy. I just want to show you what I know. And you've probably seen these already 100 zillion times, but I'm not trying to play this down. I'm just being realistic here. This is our class one. And this template they use, which I tried to understand the best I could, as many times I've been at headquarters in the chambers watching them do, this is done by a third party and then sent to ASHRAE standard, which makes the standard 34, right? So this is 410A in here. So 410A says no flammable, but there's a little flame there, obviously. The goal is if you stay inside this 90 degrees, this template, and there's a lot of science that goes behind it. And I had them repeated a couple times, the chemical engineers, but quite honestly, it was so complex. I knew I was going to butcher it to try to repeat it. So I just stay away from it, but just know that this has been around a long time. It's not just to do with refrigerants. It has to do with paint. It has to do with any kind of chemical, a flammability test. So it stays inside here. We're good to go. Clock out, go home. It's an A1, right? Here's what they saw when they went for an A2L, okay? It just broke that line. Now, they'd never seen anything like this because it's so close to this bar. To give you an example, if you were to do imaginary line on the 9 and 3 o'clock position, that's an A2, and that's considered flammable, okay? So they're scratching their head, and that's why this classification is so new. They couldn't call it a 1, even though it's closer to a 1, and they couldn't call it a 2 because it's not as close to a 2 as it is a 1. And again, I'm not trying to complicate things here, but when we look at propane, and again, I'm not trying to bust up propane.
Oh, no.
It's a whole different world, obviously. And that's the reason we have our smaller milligrams, 150, 5.2 ounces, whatever it is in the U.S. I know that UL has approved 300, 500. And propane, don't get me wrong, it's a great refrigerant. You and I all know that. It's a great refrigerant. Fun fact is, Aldi's does all their store. It's a German-based company, all their store in the U.S., with CO2, but over in Germany, they do them at 290 because that milligrams is up to 500 grams. So milligrams, it's not just about tree hugging. All those refrigerants, it's not just about that. They're very efficient refrigerants, as we know. But the flammability part is night and day. That's why sometimes I don't want to say frustrated, but when I see people doing presentations or webinars or something on flammable refrigerants and they put it all in one bucket, I think it confuses people. In my personal opinion, I have a 39-year-old that's a master's. He passed his contractor's license years ago, and friends that still arrive in service trucks like you guys, you know, they're still out there that used to be coworkers of mine. So I just don't like, for lack of better words, fear-mongering. But as far as the bridges and this DOT stuff like that, Kevin and Brett, I honestly don't know about tunnels. I've never been presented that question. I'll find out now, but I'm assuming that it's all been looked at, but I'm assuming, and I hate to assume, this is what I know. I'll just stay in the area that I do know as far as flammability.
That's fine. That's one of the things about these newer refrigerants. Like we, in California, they did a propane primary CO2 secondary.
Yeah.
But they kept the propane outside of the building, in a vessel outside of the building. And so it's not inside the building. So the job almost got shut down. They're like, you got this much propane on there. Yeah, but it's not inside. So the fire marshal was like, I don't know what to do. I don't think the laws have basically caught up to the technologies that they're trying to envelop, right? We put these,
try to put
these barriers on some of the stuff, and it's evolving so fast because the mandates are, you need to stop doing this now. Well, all right, I need to figure this out yesterday. And so the laws are like catching up with what we're doing. So like some of these things that we're talking about is like, no, we didn't even think about that.
And you're exactly right. And not that I have a crystal ball or come off like a know-it-all. 6-7 years ago when we started talking about, when I was part of that, we had a class called Fit for the Future. It was brand new the year after I came out on at Emerson. Yeah. And I helped teach that class. So it was CO2, R290, and A2Ls. It was a mix of everything, Fit for the Future, new refrigerants. As time went on, A2L became a bigger section because that's where more of the interest started going. So back then, when I started to understand more of it, I'm thinking about my everyday business working out of a truck, and I'm thinking about these building inspectors. And I know this, because it's the world we live in every day. This, I'm talking about 6 years ago, but they don't know what's coming down the pipe. And I felt at that time that there was going to be a delay with things like, hey, can that ice machine with 290 be in that corridor? Or does that door have to be removed? Or things like that. And you're exactly what you said, Brett, is what happened. That is what slowed everything down for this A2L proof and 290. Basically, you get out in front of it. The EPA sets the standard or says, this is what we're going to do. That's it. No change in it. And then the real world has to follow behind, and boots on the ground then have to figure it out. So yeah, you're exactly right. You nailed it. But it was surreal or unreal to really see this in real time go down on how those policies and those things happen and how they start to go. Because again, you, I, and Kevin, we've had those build inspectors out on the job sites, and we know they don't know, because I'm living in this every day and I'm teaching it, and the people in this room don't know it. So I know the people at the building department don't know it. So big push right now. We're actually working with the fire departments nationally, getting a program set up for them to educate them, even the volunteer fire departments. That's how far behind this thing is. But yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that.
And we also have heard there's no retrofit for any of these A2Ls. Everything has to be brand new equipment, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's no retrofit, and I don't see that changing, honestly. I've heard people say differently that aren't in the know, but I honestly don't see that changing at this time. But things change. The EPA changed their mind a month ago on the sell-through date on equipment, and you don't ever hear of anything like that. They were going to stop the presses at January 1st of 2025 and say, no more 410A and no more selling it, no more installing it. And the industry pushed back and said, look, we've got all these rooftop units in the warehouse. You don't just sell a rooftop unit overnight. You guys have done big jobs. I've swung a lot of rooftop units in. Those projects, they take time. You're sitting on that equipment for a while. Not every one of those rooftops fits the perfect piece of business you're doing. So they gave them a longer sell-through date till 2028, and then the residential stuff till 2026. Cool. Yeah.
John, I've heard some stuff like rumblings back and forth. What about the leak detection in these units? Are they required to have leak detection in the package units?
In the package units, yes. So what you're going to see is what I'm hearing anyways. We'll start with a split system because that's the only picture I have. You're going to see it.
How many failed leak detectors are we going to have? Because a ton of because of crappy duct work, Don.
Yeah. Exactly. So here's a generic picture here.
Oh man, and here we go.
Yeah. So this is a very generic picture, but I have the luxury of doing webinars with all these OEMs for the last year or so. But this particular, and I can't speak for all the OEMs, but this is on a very high level, 30,000 foot view. This is what you're going to see around the coils, basically. Let's just take this split system, for example, this V coil. So this sensor is going to come installed on one side of the coil. From what I understand, depending on which way the air is flowing, is going to be depend. So how you lay this furnace, in other words, whether it's horizontally or vertically, you may have to move that sensor to the other side. I've heard everything from it will already be installed on some OEMs, and some OEMs have chosen to put this in the bag of goodies like you do with a normal 90 plus furnace or something like that, or anything you install, right? So the way this is going to work at a very high level, first of all, it goes off. It was set to, UL set the standard for 25% LFL or lower. It couldn't be over 25% LFL. So LFL is where we light, right? What were you saying earlier today, Brett? You need oxygen, you need the concentration, and you need some force of ignition. So that's LFL. So this is going to go off below LFL.
What does that actually stand for? What does LFL stand for?
Lower flame limit. Yeah, okay. Lower flame limit. So it's UFL, LFL, and that's the window where you have those three factors, right? So the concentration's got to be inside the UFL or the LFL or to where it will ignite. So we send that sensor. So from what I'm hearing here from most everyone, seems pretty consistent that this is going to go off at 20% LFL. Now, don't hold me to that, but that's majority what I'm hearing everyone say in front of me when I'm speaking with others, okay, from the manufacturers. It's going to send a message down to the, I want to say mitigation board, that's going to go off, and it's going to do several things. So if it's in, if it's got heat strips on it, for example, or a gas furnace, it's going to shut either one of those down. If it's a gas furnace, if it's an air handler, it's going to shut those down. It's going to shut the outdoor unit down. It's going to energize G. It's going to turn the fan on, and then it's going to remove that concentration out around that coil. And then send it through the ductwork. Again, it's 20% of LFL, so it's not even flammable yet. And I showed you the picture earlier how close it was as an A1. And I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm a realistic person here. Because I working here for the time I have, and even at Emerson, when I really had no dog in the fight on what refrigerant you choose, I'm just a compressor guy. I had a lot of, oh, great, that's a great idea. They're going to blow this through the furnace, the ductwork or whatever. Or what about the gas water heater? Again, it's 20% of the LFL it goes off. It's really, in my mind, to be honest with you, it's no different than any safety switch we have. Actually, it's going to go off way sooner than any type of danger. And the secondly, the way I look at it too, is it's a leak detector. It's not going to set a fire alarm or those kind of things. Now, on your higher level stuff, your equipment, you'll probably get a lighted screen on your high tier stuff, just like we've done for years. That's been around a long time. You have some type of code or troubleshoot there. From what I understand, it don't hold me this because all the OEMs are saying things different. And I haven't even actually seen a complete manual yet, an installation manual. But let's say it runs for 5 minutes and then goes back into a regular thing. As long as there any issue, as if it was a nuisance call, it'll keep continue running the way it was before. So that's how it's going to work. When you get into the larger stuff, the larger poundage of it, that stuff, let me see if I got one here.
Today's episode is sponsored by the RefRush Shield RDP Series Differential Pressure Monitors from Westermeyer Industries, now available for transcritical CO2 systems in addition to other common pressures and refrigerants. When the filter element of your coalescing oil separator is contaminated, it can hurt your system's performance and efficiency. But how do you know when it's time to replace that filter? Wait too long to replace, and you could end up with a nasty filter blowout. But replacing too often can be a waste of time and money. The answer is installing a differential pressure monitor. The RDP series differential pressure monitors, including the new transcritical CO2 model, are available now from Westermeyer Industries. To find out more information, email sales@westermeyer.com. That's westermeyer.com.
When you get into the larger stuff where you're installing stuff out in the field, let's say big commercial jobs and things like that, where you have to add things, where larger charges involved, you might see a solenoid valve. You might see a pump down where the refrigerant goes outside. Yeah, this is an indicator for some type of ventilation. You might have a sensor in the room, okay? The A2Ls, 454B, for example, is 2.45, I think, versus air, and CO2 or R290 are the same. It's 1.52. So it's going to be heavier than that even. It's going to be lower to the ground. Those sensors will be set somewhere around 12 inches off the ground or somewhere thereabouts. So that's on a very large level, but the world that most people are going to live in between the 4 pounds on this type of comfort cooling and the 140 pound charges, this is what you're going to see at the very minimum for the most part. That's all that's really required at this time.
So they're not going to be doing anything with shutting down the suction side as well. They're just, because in my experience, especially with supermarket stuff, right? Like if you have a leak, the CO2, whatever, they want to basically just mitigate that where it's going to stop on the liquid side and then stop on the suction side. So you just leak what's in the coil and stop. Because otherwise, if you have a compressor that's leaking by or whatever, you're just going to continue to leak in that area, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. And I have not heard anything on that from the lines being shut down or blocked off, anything on that side. I get what you're going, where you're going with it, but that's what I know. And I've been with a lot of them, so not saying it's a bad idea by no means, but I have not heard anything about that. So
even a check valve, right? Like even if you put a valve on the suction side,
which you'll have if you're working with a scroll already, you're going to have that already leaving the scroll and somewhere.
No, but that's on the discharge line. I'm talking about the
good point. Yeah, you're a great point. Good point.
Because basically, if you have a leak and we're going to lop down the liquid line, but then it's just going to continue to just bleed through the suction. So if you have that suction
until it's dead.
But at that point, it depends on how much is in the system. You know what I mean? If you had a check valve around the outlet of the evaporator, then that way it would just leak from the liquid line solenoid to the suction and then not allow flow to go in the opposite direction. So you just lose it right at the unit itself.
Yeah. And really, not to play this down, but again, to go back to my thoughts on it, because I'm one of those people that I see something and I've always been one, hey, we can't do anything about that, but here's what we can do. Let go of the things you can't do. So the way I see this is, again, it's in there because it's an A2L refrigerant, but at the end of the day, it's a leak detector. Really, it's not. So if you have a hole in that coil there and it senses a leak, it doesn't matter what refrigerant's in there, whether it's an A1 or A2L. You see what I'm saying?
If
it shuts down or whatever, you're still going to be, it's just going to be the same process. In my mind, honestly, and again, I'm not trying to sell you anything here, it's actually going to help you find a leak if there isn't coils. And a lot of people get these rash of bad coils and things like that. But this is what I know now. Now, that change as time moves on and they start to get these things out in the field. As I told you earlier today, this particular OEM, for example, this picture I'm sharing, they shared with me they've had equipment out for at least a little over six years. So it's been running out in the field and testing. I know with Emerson, I on multiple occasions, at least twice anyways, in the summertime, I would jump on a plane with application engineers and we would fly down to a supermarket way out in the bayou with only one street light down in the Cajun country. And I would pull the heads off the medium side of the rack and the engineer would pull the heads. And we were testing stuffing behind the scenes for years in advance. Like I seen 513 in the labs a long time ago. And now it's like common knowledge for 134A as a drop in and what have you. One would hope that everything, the tires have all been kicked and all that kind of stuff. But as well as I do, there's always a bulletin that comes out on something like that. So I'm realistic about it. But have they crossed their T's and dotted all their I's correctly? I would like to think so, but you never know. Sometimes, unfortunately, humans learn by their mistakes, and we see that all around us all the time. As I told you earlier today, that's why we have airbags in cars now. We learn a lot when accidents happen, after things happen. But I would like to think that the thing's been tested pretty decent on that, but could it lose some charge and leak out more with the suction side? Yes, it's possible. But my thinking is, whether it's A2L or A1, it would still be the same. You know what I mean?
So what else did you want to bring up with any of the stuff on the A2Ls?
I didn't have a lineup of anything, but if you care to know, the new equipment will have these red caps on them. All the OEMs are going with a red cap, similar to what R290 is now with the red sleeves. So they'll have these red cap indicators. The other nice thing about it is if you're into, which I know my son is, they've extended these service ports, the lines, and they're stubbed out and they're not female bell fittings anymore. They're now straight fittings. So if you use the compressed type fittings, you don't have to braze that small one piece in it and get your nitrogen out. Now you can compress and start out and compress throughout the whole job site if you like to do that kind of thing. And I guess it's getting a lot of traction. I know, like I said, my son bought one less than a year ago and shot me a picture of it. He's all excited about it. But and that'll be on the indoor, outdoor. Nothing really to do with A2Ls, but that's something else you'll see there.
No, I think it's the manufacturers getting tired of getting cooked service valves and said that they weren't closing.
I saw a lot of that too as a service manager when Tober torches came out and stuff like that. They were staying on them a lot longer and seen a lot of bad valves, and everybody were saying they were junk. It was just poor preparation on the technicians. And I'm guilty of that too. I can't exclude myself.
I will never understand how somebody burns a service valve.
Because they go with a turbo torch. It's like brazen with a shotgun, right?
It's exactly what it is.
I can't stand those things.
Yeah. No, cherry red, as I used to say at Emerson all the time, is too hot. If it's cherry red, it's beyond too hot. So, yeah.
At least they made the service ports where you could throw a core puller on them again. Oh, that's the other thing, Don. Or what about core pullers? Are we going to, since they're left-handed threads?
Yeah, the left-hand threads are just on the tank.
The cores are still going to go.
Okay,
So the left-hand threads will be just on the tanks. And I didn't really care for this idea because I thought it was at first. And then I realized it made a lot of sense after a while because the tool manufacturers, from what I understand, didn't want to change. And they're still going to be making right-hand tools for the stuff that's out there. So that's a big changeover in the factories. The OEMs didn't want to change the left-hand threads. So the idea was the cheapest way or cheapest route, least path resistance, was to make this little adapter like they do in the auto industry to put on there. And that'll go on the new tanks, the left-hand threads, and then convert it back over to right-hand threads for your hoses and what have you. And then you'll have adapter also for your, let me see if I have that one here somewhere. Here, I'll drag this one over here for your, tell me if you can see that one there.
Yeah, we got it.
Yeah. So this will be for your larger tanks. That's your part number. These are difficult to find in some places. Maybe you already have them, but just like a lot of the stuff when the tanks first came out for CO2, these kind of places, Air Lindy, those kind of things, local welding shop supplies and anything like that, you can find them out there. These adapters here weren't even available, not even almost a year ago, March of last year, basically. I think is when shortly after that they announced, and then everybody started manufacturing them. You'll have the left hand, the adapter on there also.
Since we talked about the flammability a little bit, I want to segue into what we were talking about before. I called Don earlier today and we were trying to just figure out a game plan of what we're going to do. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, because this is one thing that like everyone, like whenever they see a unit that implodes, or they're just like, oh, look, flammable refrigerant. See, this is what we're going to. And Don and I were talking about it, and what I was thinking is I think it all comes down to practices, right? That's what I truly think, because we were talking, what is something that explodes needs, right? It needs something flammable, it needs an ignition source, and it also needs oxygen. So I think about it more, and I was like, the only way that you would have any oxygen within a system is if you have crappy practices.
Let Kevin chime in on that one too, and then I'll give you my thoughts on it, or I'll just give you my.
It's all blown out of proportion, just like the CO2 thing. Everybody was afraid of CO2 when it first came out.
Everyone was afraid of 410 when it came out. I remember. Oh my God, Puron crap.
I was.
Were you really?
I was one of those guys. I remember leaving the shop that morning, going, "I'm not putting that crap in my truck." Do you see those pressures? Seriously, and then starting getting around CO2, where you're 17.
I mean, everybody gets worked up over everything. Meanwhile, we're driving around with 3-4 acetylene tanks in the back of the truck that could do 50 times worse than any of this.
Kevin, you're speaking my language. I swear we've met each other personally or been around each other before, because everything you've said for the last 5 minutes is exactly the things I say. I think that I question some of the pictures and videos I've seen of exploding stuff after what I know about A2Ls. I'm not saying anything, but doing anything dishonest. I think there's just something not right there, because according to the people that I know that have those master's degrees and know chemicals really well, it's impossible for an A2L to even do that. I'm just telling you what people a lot smarter than I'm saying, and I'm with you too. I'm not really scripted in the classroom, but a lot of times if someone's giving me a, I don't know, kind of thing, it's how many of us have been driving down the road and came to a stop sign or a stoplight, leaving a job, and you smell acetylene in your truck. And the good ones will smile and start to raise their hand. And I raise my hand along with them. That's happened to all of us. And we don't think any of it. It's like,
I worked with a guy whose van actually blew up.
Oh, wow.
Like it clean blew up the van. He pulled over in the city and got out. He smelled it. He was in downtown Chicago in the loop and pulled off and got out, hit the button on the van to unlock it, and the electronic locks ignited. And it blew the van up.
Oh, my Lord.
Damn.
He went flying back like 10, 15 feet. So acetylene's way more flammable and dangerous than any A2L's ever going to be. And that was a small acetylene leak.
A2L's are, I was telling Brett earlier today, we've got 1234YF and 9 out of every 10 cars made today. That's an 8, That's an A2L. It's part of what's 454B, by the way. And it's part of what 450A and 450C are in the commercial side and the refrigeration side. And we don't think anything of it. People want to, will say, wow, really? That flammable stuff? You know what, you know, can you imagine the world we live in right now? And I'm not trying to slam anybody here. If you told people today on the national news that, hey, they're going to invent a car, we're going to start putting gasoline in it, they would stop the presses. Gasoline is, but yet we do it every day. We put our family and small children in the back seat. We don't think anything of it.
How about again, the vehicles out here in Cali that are hydrogen? There's hydrogen pump stations out here in Cali. I'm like, really?
Yeah. I was enjoyed years ago going to Southern California down there at some of the wholesalers, and it seemed like everybody had a Tesla, man. There was Teslas everywhere.
But no, like we were talking about practices, just making sure now it's the practices that we do in commercial are now just going to have to be standard, like for even residential. So even before, after you run your line set through the house and whatever braze joints, whatever joints that you're going to make, you're just going to have to pressurize before you even hook it up to the actual system.
Yeah. Going through servicing A2Ls, a lot of the stuff that was, good practice, like you said, Brett, good practice is going to be required now. Now, and I always tell everybody in the classroom, now, before you ask me who's going to police that, it's ask me who's going to police me if I released R22 years ago. I don't know. I'm just the messenger, okay? But they're going to start documenting a lot of this stuff at the job site, more so than they ever were before. You might have been writing it on the invoices before, but now they're going to require you to document that. Again, if you're out in the Wild West and you don't have a building department, and your local jurisdiction isn't doing anything for you, will you get away with it? Probably so. But inert gas to remove any residual refrigerant, line one there. Ensure equipment's grounded, proper discharge. It's really a lot of common sense stuff that we've already, most of us have been already been doing on some of these things. It's just a matter of now getting people more educated. Here's another one here that I don't know if I want to say I find it humorous, but you know, just some of the things that I've seen here. I know I was telling you earlier today, Brett, on some of this stuff, like your vacuum pumps and your pressurize the line and see if I can find it real quick. They're going to recommend a 10-foot work area. Basically what that amounts to when I say recommend, look for things that we're already doing. It's just like the utility companies do out in the corner when they're working on a corner, when they're coned off and what have you. They're required to do that. This is a recommendation at the time. It's not required. The only thing that I heard that's required that I've seen or read is if you're working on a chiller and you have a larger type of recovery machine, they throw a bigger spark or they have the potential to throw a bigger spark, that has to be 20 foot outside the work area, the work zone. But as far as everyday stuff that we do, the normal stuff that most people do in comfort cooling or anywhere else, would be a 10-foot radius. If you don't have it, you don't have it. But they want you to not really rope it off, but check and make sure ignition sources and those kind of things. And just to me, again, a lot of it's common sense. The other things, there's going to be a square amount of square footage you're going to need to know. So I'll use this as an example because it's what I have pulled up. So a lot of people, this might freak a lot of people out when they get those manuals and they say, what do you mean? I got to measure this off. I got to do all this math and stuff. So we've done the math for you. And for, let's say you have a 11 pounds charge in there. You need at minimum 160 square foot is required to dissipate 454B. Now that's like a garden shed. 164 square. They're talking about the house now. Now, when they go into mini splits, they're going to base that on room. And I don't know the exact numbers there, but the mini splits with the heads will be by room to where the split systems and those kind of things will be done by the whole square footage of the house. But you can see how easy that is to, and I'm not trying to play the A2L thing down, but you can have 5 pounds of charge as long as the house is not smaller than 74 square foot. A small house is 1,100 square foot in my world from doing slabs and things like that in my younger years. But again, I'm not trying to joke about it or make fun of it. I'm just being realistic about it.
All right, then I won't joke about it.
You could do it.
I was gonna ask how many square foots are in one bucket, just for the guys out there, because I know there's guys out there with the recovery bucket.
Somebody posted the other day, a little off topic, but he was posting how much charge he took out of a thing. And he had his hose running right in the bucket and he took the picture and he posted it. I was like, oh God. Yeah. So anyways, I know we're about out of time. I don't know if we touched on everything you wanted to talk about or not, but
it's all the rest of the stuff I'm assuming is just any other practices. I wanted to talk about some of the misnomers that people have about A2L, because there's a lot of just bad information out there.
Yeah. So there is. And I think it's getting better. than it was. Nothing to do with me, but I think it's getting a lot better. I compared to even a year ago, there's still sometimes you'll see, I get people, people, I won't mention their names, that'll reach out to me every once in a while. I go, Don, didn't you tell me there's no propane in A2L refrigerants? And I know they know the answer. And I'll just tell you the one person that approached me not long ago, we talk quite often, A-Team Adam. And he reaches out to me and I'm thinking, Adam knows that already. And he goes, I know it. I go, I'm trying to settle an argument in a room right now or something, some kind of post or something like that. It's like, are you kidding me? People are still saying that the blend is the blend. And I can show you what the blend is. And this is going to hold true with all the 454As and anybody else's, whatever brand they're selling. You look at this here. Let's look at what that is right here. Let's just look at it. I'm sorry. One more time. Here we go. The 454B, all they did from the 410A is they took the 32 from 50% to 68.9. And instead of taking this R125, as you both probably know, this R32 runs hot on the discharge line. Mm-hmm. It's a higher viscosity oil in the compressor because of that reason, more friction. The R125 only had two factors really in it. And the two factors were it kept the discharge line cool. And the other factor is the fire deterrent. You find this a chemical in fire extinguishers. So when you remove that, you remove most of the GWP. So they didn't add anything that's flammable. They just removed the fire retardant, if you will. Okay. And they added what we're using in cars. This HFO that's owned by Chemours is 1234YF, 30%. This has a global warming potential of 4. I know that's not going to be common talk in the truck, but that's where you're getting this number that the EPA likes. That's the only reason we're having this conversation. Basically, well,
that's what's in the 513. That's what's in the 449 and the 448, right?
I've
you're the first person to actually say 1234. I'm like R1234YF. I just think it sounds funny.
I used to be that guy too, just so you know. I was quickly corrected when I got here at Chemours.
It's 1200 series refrigerant. Yeah,
1234YF. Nope, it's 1234YF. That's what we call it in the lab. That's what it is.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Cool. So one more question probably.
Yeah.
So we talked about it not being in, for right now, it's not going to be any new or reused equipment. The pressure ratings, do you have PT charts that you could share briefly?
Let me show you what I do have. I can get you some PT charts and anyone that's listening could go to optian.com and you can download any of the stuff there. And there's PT charts here. So here's something, again, I'm just learning PowerPoint, so don't laugh at me, but here's just a picture I took off there. And I did some numbers like on comfort cooling. And from my experience, we're usually somewhere around SST is somewhere between 40, 45 or so. Mm-hmm. So I just plucked a number that was fair to all of them. And I added 32 about 3 months ago, because I want to be very transparent because you're going to see all of them. Yeah. But 117 on the low side, you're going to be running about 39.4 on your suction saturation temperature. 454B is going to run around 44.6. R32 is going to be 38.3. When you get into, some people consider the weeds, this is the fun stuff for me, the capacity, you're going to lose a little bit with the 454B. It's going to be down 152. But the bright side of that is probably one of the most important numbers that you guys know as well as I do is the COP, the coefficient of performance. And for those that are listening that don't know what that means in very simple terms, is how much capacity are you getting out of the evaporator and how much work the compressor is doing? That's really what it's telling you. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then highest number is the best number. So 3.587, 3.68. And then 3.65. So even though you give a little bit up on capacity here, you're using less energy on the compressor, basically, is what's telling you.
So basically, the more, like, you're getting more per kW that you're putting in electric power, more energy you're getting out of there, correct?
Correct. You are correct. You're exactly right. And if you look at the pressures here, and I've only got a few, and we can revisit this another day, but so if you're running 130 on suction pressure in 410A, you're going to be about 127, 133 on R32, 429, 395, 430. And then your discharge temperature, if you're at 179, this is 6 inches out on that discharge temperature, 191, you're going to run a little higher. Remember, we removed that R125. And then at R32 straight up, that's going to be 215. And with that said, with the R32, we're also going to need a higher viscosity POE oil on that. So for 454B and 410A, that'll stay at a 32. when it comes to glide, less than half a degree at 410A, we don't take bubble and do any consideration. You will not take that into consideration for 454B. And these glide numbers will change as whether it's air conditioner or heat pump, right? And being a single component on R32, we're not going to have any glide. So that's pretty much what I have in the details there.
All right. Kevin, you got any last thing if your internet's actually working?
No, it's pretty laggy.
All right. Don, I appreciate you coming on. I wanted to have you on because I wanted to just stop all the, hey, we heard this about this, we heard this about this, and just trying to squash a lot of these misfallacies that are coming around with A2Ls and set some people straight. You want to talk about what Chemers has going on right now? If there's anything you want to push?
What do we have on going on right now? So there's a real exciting thing on for those of you that's ever run or got that alert call on server rooms. There's a liquid out there right now that we're in the forefront of. It's getting posted everywhere. I think it's called something like a dielectric liquids, but I seen it actually at headquarters in the chambers when it was being tested and what have you. But basically what it is, liquid transfers heat better than vapor, obviously, but you'll be able to put these boards right down and almost looks like the testing
where yes.
I saw that. Did you see it there? So they're going in there.
It can put motherboards in there and it will
yes.
it out. And then
yes.
they're submerging the motherboards in this fluid. And
yes.
then instead of having to use like a secondary refrigerator, they could, but then they can just take the heat from the dielectric fluid and then run it out to a dry cooler and get rid of the heat that way.
So correct.
They really need mechanical cooling for that.
Yeah. And I was standing in the lab. They actually had it made up like they do in labs for the testing.
Yeah.
And it was like a real server room. And I was literally, my mouth dropped because how many of us haven't run a service room call and they're in panic when those go down. But I was standing within 6 inches of it and I just can't say anything. And they're explaining it to me. The engineers are, and I'm just blown away because there's no heat coming off this thing at all. None whatsoever. It's just this liquid moving around it with little bubbles, almost like an aquarium. And it's just removing that heat from those boards. And you wouldn't even know you're in that room, those rooms. Good, exciting stuff. So that's really one of the hot things that's going on right now. Not the world I live in. It's a different section of Chemours, but still pretty exciting stuff for our industry.
What other stuff you guys got going for training? What do you want for what you're doing? You said you've been traveling all over the place.
Yeah. Right now, the common one, honestly, has been just some two-hour training with a certificate. Obviously, nothing federal or state is recognized this time. So we'll wait and see what the EPA decides on that. But last week I was at Penn State University training their maintenance staff. That was a four-hour course. And sometimes, when I do a four-hour course, I start out with some basic fundamentals, things that we've already talked to that you assume, though. But with a maintenance staff, like I had people in there from a handful of less than 2 years to all the way to 42 years, like they're on their last year of retirement or whatever. So I never assume anything. I start out with some basic fundamentals, nothing too low, but that's the stuff that I'm doing. And then all of our salespeople, all the reps that rep our product are doing training too. What they have me doing is focusing on the bigger, I hate to say audiences, sounds like I'm important, but the bigger crowds, if you will. So I was with Lennox Live about a month ago, following them around to all three of their events. So anybody like an OEM, if they call the Reams of the world and those people, then I'll go to their, speak at their main events or whatever and those kind of things. But most of my world is still like in a warehouse, working with contractors, folks like ourselves. 80% of my job is that for the most part. But like they already shot me my numbers for next week. I'm going to Louisiana. It's a 3-city visit and they've had to move a couple of those locations twice now because the numbers have gotten up so high. I'm seeing nothing smaller than 50 people. I've seen as many as 247. I'm just talking about a regular training thing. I've never had to use a mic before I think maybe twice at Emerson. And I've used a lapel microphone quite a few times since I've been here, just because there's quite a bit of attraction to the A2Ls right now, obviously for obvious reasons.
Doing the big show, man. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad would be rolling over his grave. He made something of himself.
Don, I appreciate you coming on. And I don't know. I guess that's it. We'll talk to you guys next time.
See you guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Don.